quantum field theory. Or in other words, how to build pilot wave models for quantum field theory. But first I will cover the material that I did not finish last time. And it was about how to do the pilot wave theories for relativistic wave equations. And so the two well-known equations, these are the Klein-Gordon equation and the Dirac equation. The Klein-Gordon equation, it admits positive and negative energy solutions, but the problem is that the Klein-Gordon density is negative. And so even if you, and this is the case, even if you have a superposition of positive energy solution, and so you cannot interpret the Klein-Gordon equation as an equation for a wave function in the usual sense. So you have problems at the level of the standard interpretation, and these problems you have them too at the level of the pilot wave theory. So it's also problematic to do a pilot wave theory for the Klein-Gordon equation simply because it's already problematic in the standard case. And in the Dirac equation, the situation is different because you have, well, there you also have this positive and negative energy solution, but the density on the other end is positive. And so if psi is the Dirac force spinor, the density would be given by psi bigger psi. And you have the continuity equation. So you have, well, everything look nice in order to do the pilot wave theory. But first, I would like to make two remarks about the Dirac equation itself. So what does it mean to have a negative energy solution? So if you look at this classical relation, P mu is equal to the mass times dx mu divided by d tau, where tau is the proper time. The fact that you have a negative energy, either it means that the mass itself is negative, or it means that dt divided by d tau is negative. And what the first option is to say that there is no particles cannot go backwards in time, so the mass needs to be negative for negative energy solution. And there you have, if you follow this option, you have a view that was the one of Dirac, in which if you think about it classically, you have a huge sea of a negative energy particle, so you would have a huge stream of world line. The blue one would be the one that corresponds to a negative energy solution. But none of these particles go backwards in time. On the other hand, if you say that the mass needs to be positive, then the second possibility is that the particles can go backwards in time, and there you have this idea of Feynman and Schoekelberg. For instance, this would be an electron, and at some point it goes backward in time, and it's interpreted as a positron. And that's this second option that's more closely related to a standard picture of quantum field theory. And the second remark that I wanted to say about the Dirac equations is that if you start from this probability density, psi bigger psi, and if you have, at some point, if you have a Dirac particle in a ball, so that would mean psi bigger psi, zero outside of the ball. So if you have the situation, if you know that the Dirac particle is inside of a ball, you necessarily need to include the negative energy contribution in the Dirac spinor. Or another way to put it is to say that if you consider a superposition of positive energy solution for the Dirac spinor, then the support of psi is necessarily non-compact. But so now let's try to do the pilot wave theory for the Dirac electron. So you would say that in the pilot wave theory for the Dirac electron, the electron would not only be described by a force spinner, but also by its position. And for the velocity of the electron, you take the standard spatial current, and you divide it by the probability density, just like you do in the non-relativistic pilot wave theory. And the reason that you do that is because if you consider an ensemble in which the positions of the particles are distributed according to psi dag psi for some initial time t0, and if you use this guidance equation, they will remain distributed according to psi dag psi for any data time, any data time t. And that's, again, that's this property known as equivariance. And also, you can show that the velocities predicted for the Dirac electron are subliminal. And another remark is that if you take the non-relativistic limit of the Dirac current, then you get a correction to the non-relativistic guidance equation. So if you have a non-relativistic spinner, so a bi-spinner, so that was the non-relativistic guidance equation that I presented last time in the case of a spin 1/2 non-relativistic electron. But now, if you take this theory and if you take the non-relativistic limit, you get some a new term, a correction, which is known as the spin term. And here I have. So if you, well, of course, you can solve this equation in order to find the trajectory of the electron. And here, that's for a superposition of three, eigenstate of the momentum. So you'd have P1, 1, 0, 1, P2, that would be -1, -2, -1. And P3, that would be 1, -1, 1. And the mass of the electron, that's it's 10. And it starts from position 0, 0, 0. And the simulation runs from t equal to 0 to t equal to 1,000. And then you have a superposition of three eigenstates of momentum, which are right-handed. And if you zoom a bit this kind of trajectory, you see that this spin term, that's the one that is causing this kind of curly motion for the Dirac electron. Okay, no, so I will. So that was the part that I wanted to finish. So now I'll go to the core of this lecture, and that's the idea of how to extend these ideas to quantum field theory. And so why would you like to do that? Well, first, simply because to reply to the claim that the pilot wave theory cannot be extended to quantum field theory, simply because, you can read sometimes that the Brillouin theory simply doesn't work because in quantum field theory you have processes in which particles can be created and annihilated, and so pilot wave theory cannot work. And in fact, in this lecture I will show a model by Dürr, Goldstein, and Tumulka and Zanghi that does exactly this, in which particles have position, real position, can be annihilated, created, and exactly reproduce the prediction of standard quantum field theory. And in fact, when you go to, it's more the contrary that's happening, because when you go to quantum field theory, you have many kinds of behavior. So it's not particle position anymore. You have different choices of behavior. You could say that, charge density could be the behavior, particle density could be the behavior, fermion number density, field configuration. So you have various choices for pilot wave models for quantum field theory. And all these different choices will give you, in the end, different candidates for pilot wave models for quantum field theory. And if you want to select one among them, you can have a few guidelines. For instance, some of them will be stochastic, some of them will be deterministic. You could also require that the pilot wave model gives you the correct non-relativistic limit. So you have a few guidelines that you can follow. And the important point about all these models is that in the end, the choice of the Biebel that you make is going to matter for when you consider this ensemble in which the particles are not distributed according to the standard probability density. So these quantum non-equilibrium ensembles. And also it gives you a different perspective on quantum field theory because you have to look at how to define localization of particles, and it's a different perspective from the usual one. Yes?
The mass, is that supposed to be a property of the pilot wave or a property of the particles?
It's supposed to be a property of the wave function, at the level of the wave function. So the only property of the particle that is its position. So all the rest, it goes in the wave function. So here is the general plan that you can follow in order to build a pilot wave model for quantum field theory. So it's always assumed that you have some kind of Schrödinger equation in which the Hamiltonian can contain terms that create and annihilate particles. And if you want to choose some kind of preferred basis, some basis B that would correspond to your Biebel, you first define the eigenstate of this in this Biebel basis, and this eigenstate would be denoted by BQ, where B is the eigenvalue of B, and Q are eigenvalues of other observables Q, such that you have a complete set of commuting observables. And now, if you choose your Biebel, you have to find a guidance equation for your Biebel, which is such that if the Biebel configuration are distributed according to the standard probability density at the initial time T0, they will remain distributed according to the standard probability density for any later time T. So you have to find a guidance equation for your Biebel, something like B prime equal something here, that guarantees that this holds if this holds. And the last thing that you cannot choose any Biebel that you want, because in the end when you do a measurement, you end up with as I explained last time, a superposition of branches, and each of these branches they correspond to macroscopically distinct states. For instance, if you do a spin measurement, then in the end the needle of the apparatus can either point in the up direction or down direction. And so in the end, if you follow the standard interpretation, you have a superposition of your measuring apparatus being in a, let's say, a needle up or a needle down. And the only way that the Biebel can select one of these branches is if these states, the state that describes the pointer up and the state that describes the pointer down, have different typical Biebel configuration. One example, if you have a state describing a measuring apparatus in which the needle is pointing up, and if I take the charge density as the Biebel, I cannot differentiate, or if I do some cross-graining, I cannot differentiate this situation from this situation. On the other hand, if I take particle density at the Biebel, I can I can select one of these two branches. Or another way to put it is that the behavior should give you an image of the macroscopic world. It should tell you if there is a projector there, if there is a pen there. That's the only way that you can have a definite outcome when you, that the De Broglie-Bohm theory leads to a definite outcome when in measurement-like situations. And all these pilot wave models, they can be subdivided into categories. So you have the first one, that's the one that I would call the field behavior category. And this was already proposed by, such a theory was already proposed by Bohm in 1952 for the electromagnetic field. Valentini has tried to extend it for Fermi field, and Strive studied these field configurations for bosons and fermions. And well, I'll explain this approach, but I'll be more concerned by the second category. And the second category is the category in which behaviors are attributed to point light particles. And there you have two models. One that's a model that I was mentioning in the introduction by Dürr, Goldstein, Timulka, and Zanghi, in which particles of position can be created and annihilated. And also a model in which you take the Dirac seriously. And they both can be seen as a kind of continuum limit of a model that Bell proposed in 1984. And if I have the time, maybe something about the tool, about the last point about the issue about there and dress particle and another model that in which I was involved recently. But just to give you an idea of how the field approach work, I have considered the simplest case. And that's the case of a free, real Klein-Gordon quantum field theory. And in order for everything to be well defined, I will put everything on a lattice. And also it's on a one dimension, it's a one dimensional universe. So that's the free Hamiltonian. So you have these operators PX and phi x, and they satisfy these anti-commutation relation. And now, if you go to the lattice, you just replace each of these operators, the x, by you just substitute the x by some lattice index L. And all these integral over dx, you replace them by the sum of all the lattice points multiplied by the lattice spacing A. And that's what you get for the lattice Hamiltonian. And you can also reabsorb the lattice spacing in the definition of the field of the lattice fields P, phi and pi. And that's what you have in the end. But now I can choose a preferred basis, and this would be the basis in which I have field eigenstates. So these eigenstates at each of the lattice points, they specify the value of the field. So if I have only, let's say, capital L lattice point, and if I have this eigenstate, if I measure the field at all the lattice point, I simply get the value phi L. And now the probability density to observe your system in some field configuration phi one up to phi. Okay, here there should be a L, capital L, you see here. This would simply be given by the scalar product of psi t with this eigenstate of the field. And now if you use the expression for the Hamiltonian, you find this expression for the evolution of this quantity. But so it really looks like a non-relativistic Schrödinger Hamiltonian if you replace any of these phi by a position x1 up to xn xl. So now the idea in this, if you want to take the field as the Biebel, you say that the complete description of your one-dimensional universe is given by this wave function, and also by the actual value of the field at each of the lattice point. And now, since the equation that I have shown at the last slide, well, really looks like a non-relativistic Schrödinger equation, the equation that you have in the end are really the same. So for the evolution of each of the field, you take the partial derivative of S, where S is the phase of your wave function, with respect to phi L, and you just plug in the actual value of the field in this formula. And this will give you the evolution of your field Biebel configuration. And this is equivalent in the sense that if the field Biebel configuration are distributed according to the standard probability density at the initial time, it will be the case for any little time. And so did something very similar already in 1952 for the case of the electromagnetic field. But now some people have tried to extend these ideas to Fermi fields, for instance, Valentini, by using Grassmann field for fermions, and also there was another model proposed by Holland. And all these approaches have been shown to be problematic. If you want the details, you can see there is a review paper about the field as Biebel approach for quantum field theory by Stoev, in which he points out the problems that you have if you take field configuration for fermions. So the conclusion at this stage is that it works fine for bosons, but if you go with field Biebel configurations for fermions, it doesn't work anymore. So that was the analysis of Stoev, that there is no field Biebel for fermions. And now in 2007, Stoev and Westman came with this idea that it doesn't really matter if you don't have field Biebel for fermions. Only field Biebels for bosons are sufficient. And that would be the claim, for instance, that if you consider QED, it's sufficient to give Biebel for the electric field and the magnetic field. And that's sufficient to select one of the branches of your superposition in a measurement-like situation. And in fact, the model that they have proposed, it's very similar to the model that I have presented in the last lecture about how to do the pilot wave theory for a spin 1/2 particle. Because if you go back to spin 1/2 particle, you only have a position Biebel. You don't have any Biebel for the spin. And if you look at the guidance equation of the particle, you simply trace, well, here summations are understood, but you trace over all the degrees of freedom that belong to the spin. And in the model proposed by Stoev and Westman, the spin degrees of freedom are played by the fermionic degrees of freedom, and the role played by the position is played by the transverse A field. And that's the equation that they have. And if you look at the guidance equation, you simply sum over the Fermi, fermionic degrees of freedom. But so in the end, you have a model in which the electric field and the magnetic fields are the variables. And here is how you describe the Stern-Gerlach experiment in this model. Well, first, that's the classical image that we have about the Stern-Gerlach experiment. So here, what is gray or black, that means positions. Well, here of fermions. So you would have, of course, positions here of particle, and then positions of particle when the particle can go up or down. Then you have the screen, which is also made of particle, and it's connected by some wire to some pointer needle that can go up or down. And now if you go, that's the classical image that we have about this experiment. But now if you go to the model introduced, the minimalist pilot wave model by Streiff and Westman, there are no variables for fermions, but they are only variables for the electric and magnetic field. So before the measurement takes place, you only have the magnetic field as the variable. That's the only thing that exists beside the wave function. And here, that's the radiation that is connected to whether the needle is in position up or down. And so that would be the transition from the situation in which, let's say, the needle is in this stage, from the situation in which the needle points up in the final experiment. So that's all there is to it. But here the idea is that the electric field and the magnetic field carry some information about the fermions, because, for instance, light would be diffracted when it comes to this object. Whether this object is here or there, the information will be reflected in the electric field. And they also propose some model in which they try to define some kind of variable for the, for instance, for Fermi degrees of freedom, but it has like a bit of a, it works, but it doesn't seem, it has more like a bit cooked up feeling to it. So. Okay, so that's what I wanted to say about this field as variable approach. Now I will consider the approach in which you have point-like variables for fermions. And these all start with a model that John Bell proposed in 1984 in a paper entitled "Variables for Quantum Field Theory." And his idea was to, well, in 1984, there was no, only the model of 1952 by Bohm was known about how to introduce variables for the electromagnetic field. And so Bell wanted to show that you could also devise a model in which you can attribute variables to fermions. And he considered, a lattice quantum field theory in which you have Fermi fields at each of the point. And there, the preferred basis that he has selected, that's the basis that corresponds to the fermion number density or fermion number lattice operator. So each of these side that would be a Dirac field, and the operator psi dagger L, psi L, that would measure the number of fermions at each of these lattice points. And now, if you have different species of Dirac fermions, you just sum over all the species. And now, if you take this fermion number lattice operator, and if you sum over all the lattice sites, you get the fermion number. And the eigenstate of the fermion number, they would be denoted by NQ. So where Q would be eigenvalues of, let's say, other observables, such that we have a complete set of observable Q with the fermion number lattice operators. And this N here, it would denote a fermion number density configuration. So it means that N specifies the number of fermions that you have at each site of the lattice. And this expression, that would give you the probability, if the state is psi t, that would give you the probability density to find, let's say, your universe in some fermion number density configuration n at time t. So the idea of Bell was to promote this fermion number density configuration to a B-able. So according to the model by Bell, the complete description of a system or universe would not only be given by a state psi t, but also by some fermion number density configuration. So at each time, there is a definite number of fermions at each point of the lattice, and they are evolving. And now, as far as the guidance equation are concerned, for psi t, you keep the usual Schrödinger equation, but for the evolution of the fermion number density configuration, you have a stochastic jump rate. So the jump rate, it's specified by this quantity TMNT. So that's the probability density to jump from some configuration N to some configuration M at time T. And here the difference with the model proposed by Bohm is that you introduce a stochastic element. So the evolution law for the B-able is not deterministic anymore. But even if this evolution law is stochastic, it guarantees that if you consider an ensemble and if the fermion number density configuration are distributed according to the standard probability density for some initial time T0, they would remain distributed according to the standard probability density for any later time T. Again, that's this property known as equivariance. And here is what John Bell was saying about the fact that he introduced a stochastic element. So he said that the stochastic transition probabilities replace here the deterministic guiding equation of the Debreuil-Bohm pilot wave theory. The introduction of a stochastic element for B-ables with discrete spectra is unwelcome, for the reversibility of the Schrödinger equation strongly suggests that quantum mechanics is not fundamentally stochastic in nature. So however, I suspect that the stochastic element introduced here goes away in some sense in the continuum limit. And as I mentioned in the outline, you have two kind of continuum version of the Bell model. And the first one, that's the one due to Dürr, Goldstein, Tibulka, and Zanghi. And in their proposal, they take So they start from the paper by John Bell, and they take a fermion number to mean number of fermions plus the number of antifermions. And they want to have a theory that would give some kind of basis to the Feynman diagrams that you have in quantum field theory. For instance, here in this, if you consider this situation, well, their goal is to have a theory in which a particle has a position viable until the moment of this particle, let's say, gives rise to, if it's a photon, if it gives rise to an electron and a positron. But here they would be able for this particle disappear, and then you have a particle position viable for the electron and the positron. And so here's how they do it. They start from the Schrödinger equation, and they make a splitting of the Hamiltonian into a free part that commutes with the particle number and some interaction part that doesn't commute with the particle number. And now you have, so that's the part that corresponds to the state. And now you have to introduce a configuration space for your viable. And for this configuration space, they introduce a union of disjoint configuration space QN. So here, Q0, that would be the configuration space in which you have zero particle. Q1, that would be the configuration space in which you have one particle. So it would be something like R3. Q2, that would be the configuration space in which you have two particles, and it would be something like R6. And at each of, at each time t, the viable belongs to one of these configuration space. So let's say if the viable is in the configuration space Q2, you have two particles, it's somewhere in R6, and you can deduce the two positions of your particle. But now, in order to cover the fact that you can have particle creation and annihilation, the viable has to jump from this, from a, let's say it has to jump from a configuration space to Q1 to Q2. That's the situation that would correspond to this process you have. You have one viable in R3. At some point, you jump to the configuration space Q2, in which you have two position viables. And for the guidance equation, for the equation of motion for this viable, you have two parts to it. You have a deterministic part and a stochastic part. The deterministic part, it's related to the Hamiltonian H0, and it corresponds to the motion in the same configuration space. So if you are in Q2, you have one deterministic part in the guidance equation that corresponds to the motion in Q2. But then you have a second part in the equation of motion, and that's a jump rate that makes you switch from configuration space with a different particle number. And that one, it's related to the interaction Hamiltonian. So again, an example of the beta decay. So here you have two down quarks. You have one U quark, and the down goes to a U quark, and you have an emission of the W, and then the electron and the neutrino. So in their model, so you would be somewhere in Q3. So you would have the particle position viable for these three particles. And at some point, there is a jump to the configuration space QQ5, in which you have particle position variables for all your five particles. But when you remain in the same configuration space, the evolution is determined by H0. And it's only when there is a jump that the jump is determined by the interaction part of the Hamiltonian. And in order to consider how these two parts of played by the free Hamiltonian and the interaction Hamiltonian, you can consider the probability density to find an electron at some point x. So that's how you define the probability density to find the electron at position x in their model, where the summation over the index a is understood. And now if you take the partial derivative of this quantity, so you would have two parts in the continuity equation. You would have the part which is connected to the free Hamiltonian, and this would give you a divergence. And you would get another part here, which is connected to the interaction Hamiltonian, and that's the one that. So this one, its cause, its consequence is the fact that the integration of rho phi tx over R3 is not conserved anymore. And you can develop this expression, and you can easily attribute it to jump rates to different sector of your variable configuration space. And here if you work out the details, you would find that this expression appears, the one related to the interaction Hamiltonian, and that's the one which is connected to the jump rate to another sector of your configuration space with a different particle number this time. But so there is a second possibility to view the model proposed by Bell, and that's the one in which you interpret fermion number as the number of positive energy fermions plus the number of negative energy fermions. And this is related to the Dirac-C picture. So let's look at the beta decay process, but from a perspective of the Dirac-C concept. So here you have four types of fermions. You have the U quark, the D quark, the electron, and the electronic neutrino. So each of these particles would have a C associated to it. So that would be the C of negative energy U quark. That would be the C of negative energy down quark. That would be the C of negative energy electron. And that would be the C of electronic neutrinos. And now, In the initial state, you have one particle, positive energy, U quark, on top of the C, and you have two down quark on top of the sea. In the final state, now you have two U quark on top of the sea, you have one down quark on top of the sea, and you have one electron on top of the sea, and you have a hole in the sea of electronic neutrinos. And this hole correspond to the anti-neutrino that you have in the final state. But now if you count the number of fermions in this process, and provide that you put like appropriate cutoffs, like ultraviolet and infrared cutoffs, in order to have a finite number of fermions in your sea. Then if you count the number of fermions, you see that then the number of fermions is conserved. But so the idea in this Dirac-C pilot wave model is to attribute position to all the fermions. But no fermions would mean positive energy fermions or negative energy fermions. And then you would have some kind of I call it monstrous, but wave function in which you have to include all the fermions. So including all the fermions that you have in the sea. But the, here the interesting part is that this number is doesn't change because just because the fermion number is conserved. So in principle, you could do a pilot wave theory in which the complete description of your universe is given by this wave function, but also by the position of all your fermions. But now where fermions again means positive or negative negative energy fermions. And you can also find the guidance equation for your fermions, which are such that the, again that this equivariance property is guaranteed. The thing about this model is that it's a bit related to your question whether the mass is a property of the beable or not. Here, that's the for instance in this model the like the flavor whether the particle is an electron, a U quark, or well, that's not something that is carried by the beable. It's at the level of the wave function. So just like the spin 1/2 in the model of the in this model was not a real property of the particle, but the property of the wave function. And in fact, the first suggestion to consider the Dirac-C concept seriously was first proposed by Bohm, Miley, and Calogero. And in fact, if you look at the Bell model, well, you remember that Bell was suspected that his model would become deterministic in the continuum limit. And now, if you interpret like fermion number as the number of positive and negative energy fermions, you get, if you take the continuum limit, the Dirac-C, this Dirac-C pilot wave model. But so there are several things that might be problematic with this model. The first is that well, the standard model of particle physics predicts fermion number violation. But this has never been observed to now. The other thing is that if the neutrino particle is a Majorana, Majorana particle, then the Dirac C concept doesn't work. And so if this is the case, this Dirac C pilot wave theory doesn't work either. And so another thing of interest is how to put this on curve space time. But for the standard model of particle physics, you can do this model in detail. Put all the cutoffs to have something which is well defined, in which fermions have positions at all times. So now I'll come back to the. So we have these two models. The one by Dirac, Goldstein, Timilkin, and Zanghi, the Dirac C pilot wave model. And we can analyze the Stern-Gerlach experiment from the perspective of both models. So here, that's the kind of image that you have from the model proposed by Dirac. I should call it the continuum stochastic Bell model with Jim. That's the kind of image that you have, because particle positions are deviable for fermions at least. And so that's the kind of image that you would have for your variables in the theory. It's something like this. On the other hand, that's the kind of image that you would have in the Dirac C pilot wave model. Because you attribute position variables to the usual particle, but you also attribute position particles for all the negative energy particles that you have in your C. So you would have this kind of background here, and that would correspond to the fermions that you have in the C. But in fact, that's the true image that both models give. That's the correct image that the model gives. So they give like a cloud from which you, in principle, you cannot identify anything. Unless you do some further work. And here in this model, the reason is the following, that all the, if you use particle in quantum field theory, and if you use the Fock basis for your particle, it's always like bare particle. So these are not the standard dress particle, if you want to put it. And so here, if you have your vacuum, that's not something like this. You have creation and annihilation of bare particles. So you would have also a cloud. And you can expect that the density of bare particles that you have in this model is related to the cutoff that you have in your quantum field theory, so that it would go something like if you take, for instance, the Planck cutoff, you can imagine that the density of bare particles that you have would be something like 10 to the 105 per cubic meter. And here on the left, there's the situation in the Dirac C pilot wave model. You have the same problem with you also have an ontology in terms of bare particles. But here, you also have the issue about the fact that you have negative energy fermions. And at first, you can think, well, if I have all these fermions in the Dirac C, in principle, the fluctuation could be so high that I could not identify whether I have a table or not, because the usual density that you have for usual method, it's about 10 to the 30 per cubic meter. If you if let's say if the lattice spacing is a cubic lattice in which you have the spacing is only one angstrom. And if you compare this with the density of particles that you have in your sea, that would be something like 10 to the 100 105, because the Planck length that's that's roughly 10 minus 35 meter. And you, so in principle, you can imagine that the fluctuation that comes from the density of fermions that you have in your sea, due to the fact that the density is so high, you can imagine that the fluctuation that you would have in the sea would be so important that they would totally wash out any image of your macroscopic world. And there you have to see, you have to do further calculation to see how big are the fluctuation of fermion number density in your sea. And you can, if you do the details, you see that if you do a small coarse graining, well, the fluctuations are rather constrained on the small scale. So if you do a coarse graining, you can wash out all these fluctuations of the particles that you have in the negative energy sea. And you can then discard some constant and find some kind of image of your macroscopic world. And here, the same would probably be hold. You would have to discard the fluctuation of the some kind of fluctuation of the bare particles in order to reveal the classical image of your macroscopic world of tables, chairs, measuring apparatus, and all that. So I guess this concept of bare and dust particles is probably, I don't need to explain more about it. So. Well, is it clear for everyone, I guess? So I was just, so probably I should skip. So the conclusion of both these models is that all the pilot wave models in which you have behaviors for particles, they attribute position behavior to bare particles. So there is no model that does this for dust particles. And if you think about the concept of the bare mass classically, so if you think about the electron as being a very small ball of a very small radius, then the dust mass of the electron, that's the sum of the bare mass of the electron plus some self-energy contribution. But as the radius of your classical electrons become small enough, you get a huge self-energy contribution. And the only way to end up with a finite dust mass in the end is by taking a bare mass which is negative and which is huge. So that's the kind of problem that you have to face. But of course, that's all classical, but it indicates the kind of problem that you have to face when you follow this bare particle ontology seriously, the kind of issue that you have to address. But in the standard model, it's kind of different because all the fermions, they are fundamentally massless. And they get their bare mass by interacting with the Higgs condensate, But you can simply forget this issue about whether my bare electron is a negative mass, because in the standard model, the answer is clear. All the fermions have a bare mass equal to zero. They get some kind of effective bare mass by the interaction with the Higgs condensate. This effective bare mass is corrected by self-energy effects in order to yield a dress mass in the end, which is positive. But so, if you consider the history of the universe, there is a, you start from here, and there is a phase in which the X field condensate, and that's the phase where you can say that the electron have acquired their mass. And this you can also, well, this kind of picture, you can read it in some paper by Wilczek, in which he said that in the very early universe, when temperature were much higher, the Higgs condensate that no fields or space could not have maintained its alignment over extended distance. In a word, it melted, just as a superconductor heated beyond its critical temperature goes normal. Or a magnet heated above its curie temperature loses its magnetization. The universe would then have been in a different, more symmetric phase. In this phase, W and Z bosons, like photons, color gluons, and gravitons, at zero mass, as deep quarks and leptons. So that means that if you want to have some kind of fundamental pilot wave model for quantum field theory, which is valid even before the Higgs field even before the condensation of the Higgs field, you should think about all the fermions as being fundamentally massless. And the first thing that you can do, if you try to take this picture seriously, is to put the mass equal to zero in the Dirac equation. And if you do this, you see that the Dirac spinor decouples in two spinor, which are vial spinor. So if you start from the Dirac equation, put mass equal to zero, well, and if you use some representation of the gamma matrices called the vial representation, you find two independent a pair of vial equations. And in fact, even in the case where the mass of the Dirac particle is different from zero, you can think about the Dirac electron as being made of two vial particles. And that's a kind of picture that Penrose takes seriously in his book, The Road to Reality. So he says that one can view the electron as being made of two particles, the Zic, two Vic particles, the Zic and the Zac. And they are continuously converted into one another. And being massless, they should move at the speed of light. So in this picture of Penrose, the fact that an electron, even if it's made of two massless particles, can give the impression of moving with a velocity which is subliminal is simply because, like this, if you move on the light cone, you can do, for instance, this would be like the Zic particle. It becomes a Zac, a Zic, a Zac, a Zic, a Zac, or something like this. But then the overall trajectory of your electron can give the impression that at each well, that you have some kind of massive electron. And so in the same book, Toppenroos says that this image of Zeke and Zach, a Zeke and Zach process should be taken with caution because, so this is only like one part of the propagator. And if you have to consider the full electron propagator, you have to sum over all the Feynman diagrams that contributes to the total fermion propagator. But nevertheless, he thinks that one could think about this Zeke and Zach particle as being the real constituents of the electron. And he further says that, well, these two viral particles should have the same electricity. And so this last work that I'm going to present, that's in collaboration with Howard Wiseman, and that's a kind of, it's a bit like trying to do a pilot wave model for this zigzag electron and see if we can give some precise meaning to the claim that Penrose makes in the road to reality. So now I'll go in the detail of this picture, maybe probably quickly. So you start from the Dirac equation, and you use one representation of the gamma matrices, which is called the Weyl representation. So here sigma zero, that would be the identity 2x2 matrix, and sigma one, sigma two, sigma three, these are just the usual Pauli matrices. On the other hand, if there is a tilde on top of it, it means that sigma zero is still the 2x2 identity matrix, but then sigma tilde one, that's minus sigma one, sigma tilde two, that's minus sigma two, and sigma three tilde, that's minus sigma three. And now if you put mass equal to zero in this equation, use this representation, and write your Dirac spinor as two by spinor, one called L and one called R, you end up with a pair of Weyl equation. And this, as I will show now, this L and R index are related to the electricity operator. For instance, in this Weyl equation, if you look at a positive energy solution of your Weyl particle, the positive energy solution is left-handed. On the other hand, the negative energy solution is right-handed. In the other Weyl equation that you get, there you have the reverse. The positive energy solution is right-handed, and the negative energy solution is left-handed. Where the electricity operator is defined by this this operator here. So that's what I just said. Right-handed positive energy, right-handed negative energy are left-handed. For this equation, this Weyl equation, you also have a conserved current, which is given by this expression. And here is how the plane wave solution look. So that's an eigenstate of the helicity, a right-handed eigenstate of the helicity, and that's a left-handed eigenstate of the helicity for the negative energy solution. And on the left-hand side, you have the same buffer for the second member of the pair of Weyl equation. So positive energy left-handed, negative energy right-handed. Again, a conserve for current, and here are the plane wave solution. So here the positive energy solution left-handed, negative energy solution right-handed. And the first, in trying to look at this idea of Zeke and Zach electron, the first thing that you can do is to try to do the pilot wave theory for the Weyl particle. And again, that's the same recipe. You have a continuity equation, so you simply take the spatial current divided by the density. And the funny thing now is that the Weyl particle always move luminally in the pilot wave theory. This might sound trivial, but if you consider, for instance, a massless Dirac electron, that's not the case. If you do the pilot wave theory for a massless Dirac electron, you don't necessarily have that the Dirac electron moves luminally. And here are just a few superpositions of a few trajectories for Weyl particle to show the kind of motion that you have for these particles. And again, it's a superposition of three right-handed Weyl particle of positive energy. And again, you have this kind of curly motion that you have for the Dirac particles. Now, in order to analyze the idea of Penrose, in order to see if we can represent the Dirac electron as an oscillation between two Weyl particles, the Zeke and the Zach, you can rewrite the Dirac quantum field theory as a Weyl quantum field theory in which you have interaction between the two Weyl particles. So the recipe that's standard, you start from the Dirac Lagrangian. And each of these four spinors, you are going to split them into psi L and psi R. So you are going to end up with an expression for your Lagrangian, which involves psi L and psi R. And then you do you quantize the theory and you look for the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian. But if you do the details, you will find that a right-handed electron can be indeed rewritten as a superposition of two Weyl particles. But these two particles, one needs to have positive energy and one needs to have negative energy. And also, they have the same helicity. And if you go, for instance, in the limit, so this would be for a right-handed massive electron, and that would be an oscillation between a positive energy Weyl particle right-handed plus negative energy Weyl particle also right-handed. And if you go in the limit where the in the relativistic limit, this term would simply disappear because E would be roughly equal to P, and you would regain, let's say, a var spinor. And so the stuff that we did was to take this image seriously and to propose a model in which, inspired by the model by Dürr, Goldstein, Temulkin, Zanghi, in which you can have jumps between these two kinds of particles. So the pilot wave theory would be, you would have some deterministic motion, for, let's say, for the Zeke particle, and then there is some jump rate that converts the Zeke into a Zach, inspired by the model by Dürr, Goldstein, Temulkin, and Zanghi. And so here, that's the simulation that we did. So you see there are two trajectories. So one that's for the usual theory for the Dirac electron. So that would be the red one. And the other one, that's the, let's say that's the pilot wave model for the zigzag electron. And that would be the blue one here. And here you see all these discontinuities in the trajectories. Their origin is the fact that the Zeke gets into a Zach and vice versa. So, but in principle, that's two models for the Dirac electron that gives you the same prediction as the standard pilot wave theory. So for it, thanks. So is there any question about this? Well, yeah, the funny thing is that you can have a model in which I didn't stress it, in which also the electron is moving always terminally. So here, at each point, the velocity of your electron is the velocity of light. But it can nevertheless give the appearance to, as I explained here, it can give the appearance to move with a massive particle.